I want to talk a bit about the clouds, just to wrap things up. The clouds is fascinating because I think it's the first fully extant philosophical work in the Western tradition. Most people say that Plato's dialogues are the earliest complete philosophical works that have come down to us. But I think that Aristophanes is a philosopher. And the reason I think he's a philosopher is because he gives us plenty of clues in the play itself to indicate that he's a philosopher. Remember that the philosophers are followers of nature. They derive their wisdom from nature. Whereas Aristophanes is often regarded as simply a person who is conservative in a simple, maybe simplistic sense. He looks to tradition for his wisdom. Right. And he's regarded as the first great reactionary in the Western tradition, the first great knee-jerk conservative. But although you'd have to say that Aristophanes is conservative, he's not a person who gives primacy or priority to tradition. He says that he is one of those nourished by the clouds, and the clouds represent looking to nature for wisdom, a kind of wisdom that goes according to nature. For Aristophanes, wisdom according to nature is going to involve looking specifically to human nature. That's where he differs from the previous Greek thinkers, because both the sophists and the natural philosophers were not concerned with human nature. The sophists were only to the extent that human nature was manifest in the form of desire. That was really the only thing they were concerned with. They did not see, though, that there was any moral law that nature taught us. And so the two main differences between Aristophanes and the previous people who looked to nature for guidance are this. Aristophanes believed that human nature is our primary guide, primary source of wisdom, and that there is a right way of doing things, a right way of living according to nature. But you have to look to human nature to discover that. You can't look to the nature of gnats and fleas in order to discover how human beings should live. But if we look to ourselves, to the human condition, to human nature, to human life, you're going to find clues as to how to live well. And so Aristophanes is a follower of this idea of wisdom according to nature, and therefore he's a follower of the clouds. But his understanding of exactly what sort of nature he's looking to is different from the earlier ones, because he doesn't overlook the human. And he sees that there's a right and a wrong way of doing things that you can discover through an examination of human nature. And this is very clear. We'll put it this way. Aristophanes makes it very clear that Socrates, although he looks to nature, does not gain what you could call genuine wisdom. Or another way of putting it is that the idea of wisdom from nature that Socrates represents really just boils down to this, that he knows what you would call science. Right? He's got a kind of theoretical grasp of the way things are. However, there's another sense of the word wisdom, and that's practical wisdom, right? The ability to get along in life, to do the right thing. And Socrates is entirely bereft of practical wisdom. He has no idea how to deal with Strepsiades or Pheidippides. And that comes out in many different ways. The first clue is when Strepsiades promises him, if he's taught the speech that pays nothing back, that he'll pay whatever fee is required. Now, that's self-evidently contradictory to any person with a sense of practical human affairs, but Socrates doesn't even notice it. That's very interesting to see how foolish, in a way, Socrates is. He thinks he's becoming wise, but really, by any conventional standard or any sort of natural use of the word wisdom and folly, you'd have to say that Socrates is a fool. And so another thing that Aristophanes is really pointing towards here is the idea that what wisdom truly is not knowledge of nature. Because that can make you a fool. What wisdom has to be then is knowledge of what's right by nature, which requires that we know human things, we know ourselves, and we discover what's good, and therefore we can, in some sense, regulate our actions in accordance with what's good. So what wisdom for Aristophanes is the ability to make right use of things, make right use of anything, including knowledge of nature, scientific knowledge. You see, the clearest indication that a kind of knowledge is not wisdom is if you can think of a situation where that can be used foolishly. Right? Science claims to be wisdom. Okay, well, if it's wisdom, then there can be no conditions under which science could be a form of fault of folly. But yet we know of instances where scientific knowledge has been used in a foolish way. But if wisdom and science are the same thing, you'd never find foolish science. So we know that there's a difference between wisdom and science, because science requires wisdom in order to be used rightly. It can't be used rightly from its own resources, and therefore it needs to be supplemented from something that comes outside of it. And that's a clear enough indication that science is not wisdom. Now, that kind of argument will be very useful when you go through the theages, too. So we'll see that later.
Aristophanes then sort of a transition person between pre-Socratic and Socratic thought?
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah, and the way I would put it is this. Aristophanes is, in a sense, the inventor of what you could call pre-Socratic thought. Because what Socratic thought is going to be is simply, again, looking to the human condition for moral wisdom. That's the Socratic Platonic model of what philosophy is, the search for wisdom through coming to understand the human condition. And wisdom is being defined here as the ability to make right use of things, the ability to live well, as opposed to just scientific knowledge that's really of no practical purpose. Remember what Socrates says when Strepsiades says, why are we studying these things? For nothing. There's no practical import to what Socrates is doing. It's a purely theoretical activity. That's pre-Socratic wisdom. Socratic wisdom, or if you will now, Aristophanian wisdom, is practical wisdom. And it's directed towards good conduct, towards living well, and it bases this capacity to live well on a knowledge of human nature. One interesting question is this. In the clouds, Aristophanes shows how the earlier natural philosophers brought about the collapse of morality in society and therefore paved the way for the sophists. And the means by which they bring about the collapse of morality is by undermining the traditional religion. Because Zeus hurls thunderbolts at perjurers, right? And you'd never dare lie in the law court and be a sophist, in other words, if you really believe that Zeus would smite you dead with a thunderbolt. But once Strepsiades has been relieved of that scruple, of that fear of the gods, then the way is clear for him to be a scoundrel, and it leads to his own corruption and the corruption of his son. And so science undermines morality by undermining religion. And the reason why it undermines morality by undermining religion is that traditional religions are filled with moral teachings, and they give sanctions, carrots and sticks, right, for doing good and bad. And natural science does not have a moral teaching, as Socrates and the pre-Socratic thinkers practiced it. Again, they looked to nature and saw no moral law at all. They just saw a bloody struggle for survival, and they thought that morals were simply conventional, and that these conventions represented, in some sense, an imposition on the liberty of the mind that was somewhat ignoble, and they also represented an imposition on our natural desires, and therefore they were to be regarded with contempt. For the pre-Socratic philosophers, morality sort of goes out the window, because they regarded this morality and religion as of a piece, and they regarded them as merely conventional and as not fundamentally true. And so they were somewhat contemptuous of morality and religion, simply because they were conventional, and because, as conventions, they, in a sense, prevented us from seeing nature as it is, and also preventing us from living by nature in our own lives by satisfying our desires. So the pre-Socratic thinkers undermine religion and thereby undermine morality altogether. Now, when you look at Aristophanes, though, you see a thinker who believes that there's a right and a wrong according to nature. That you could turn away in principle from traditional religion and traditional morals. And yet you wouldn't be bereft of moral guidance because you could look to nature for your moral guidance. That on Aristophanes' model, that's possible. Yet there's something very peculiar about the clouds. The clouds go out of their way to recognize the gods of the city. They pay respects to the gods of the city. And the question is, why would Aristophanes pay respect to the gods of the city if he believed that he did have, in a sense, in effect, a higher court to appeal to, namely nature, in order to teach morals? Okay. Do you see the question? Aristophanes could turn away from traditional religion and traditional morality because he believed that nature could teach morals. But then, when you look at the behavior of the clouds, which sort of personify this kind of wisdom according to nature, the clouds take great pains to pay lip service to, or recognize at least, the gods of the city. But why do they need to recognize the gods of the city if they can appeal to nature to teach morals? It seems paradoxical. What's the necessity of preserving the gods if you have an appeal to nature?
To be politically correct, so it wasn't banished or anything.
Well, I mean, that would be a sort of external, I suppose, reason, right? You don't want to get your fellow citizens angry at you, so you go around paying lip service to their beliefs. But is there another meaning besides that?
Not clear to me that Aristophanes would also really detect the conventional religion. In fact, the clouds really are. They indulge, they encourage the folly, the arrogance of beings. Mm-hmm. They draw out and encourage the folly and arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
They encourage the folly and stupidity of Socrates and folly and stupidity of Strepsiades and so forth. And in the end, they turn around and say, well, now you get to
And that's not unlike the Olympian gods, who are constantly playing tricks on mortals and getting them to be hubristic and then punishing them. But there is a sense, though, I think that, well, put it this way, if you look at the just and the unjust speech and their contest, and you ask yourself why the just speech fails, you have to give it one reason for that failure, that the just speech depends upon the gods in order to back up its moral teachings. And yet it fails precisely because it depends upon the gods. And that, I think, is an indication to us in a very subtle way that Aristophanes regards an appeal to the gods as, at least in some cases, something that undermines moral teachings. Right? And so that would give even more force to the question, if he regards the gods as such bad moral examples, why not dispense with them altogether? Why not toss them out and go directly to nature? It is an interesting question, because he does seem to want to pay lip service to or recognize the gods, even though he gives very good indications that his own values, the more traditional values that he wants to uphold, are in fact undermined by the very religious revelations that are being brought forward back them up or to shore them up, to justify them. Yeah, it is interesting that Hermes, the god, appears at the end, which is another gesture in the play, right, that the playwright is recognizing the gods, even though he recognizes the limitations of the gods. Another thing that's very interesting is near the end of the play, when Strepsiades and Pheidippides are arguing after the beating, When Pheidippides hints around that maybe mother beating is on the agenda, Strepsiades snaps and refuses to hear anymore, he swears an oath by Zeus. Now, Zeus is the god not only of the law courts, but also of the patriarchal family. And he suddenly realizes that the Zeus he had to overthrow in order to cheat on his debts is the Zeus he needs to appeal to preserve his family's order, and Pheidippides says, Zeus doesn't even exist, you know, Vortex is king. Now, either he's just mocking his father's stupidity by repeating his father's words, or you get a sense that Pheidippides himself really doesn't understand the all of Socrates' teachings either. Okay, either way, I think the latter one's more interesting as an interpretation. But Strepsiades responds, "Well, Zeus does exist. He does exist." And really, when you boil down, when you sort of strip away what he really means, he's saying he must exist. He's got to exist. Because the utility of Zeus is now apparent to him. Zeus provides an important prop to the moral order. And he needs that appeal if the family and the institutions of the society are to be preserved. Now, but it's interesting, why couldn't we all just explain to the Strepsiadeses of the world that that's all well and good, but there's a better reason. There are natural reasons for being honest and respecting your father and not having incest in the household. We can just put aside these religious superstitions and appeal to what's right by nature. And all you need to do is teach Strepsiades and Pheidippides what's right by nature. But let's just at least enumerate a few things. Paying your debts, respecting your father, honoring your mother, not beating up the old man, and so forth. These would be things that would be right by nature in the context of the play. Why not just teach Strepsiades and Pheidippides what's right by nature? Then you could dispense with the government. But let's just pretend that none of this horrible stuff ever happened. And instead of Strepsiades and Pheidippides going into Socrates' thinkery, they went into Aristophanes' thinkery instead. And Aristophanes said, look, guys, Zeus doesn't exist, and Vortex isn't king either. But look, you should pay your debts, and you should honor your father, and honor your mother, and be a good guy, because couldn't you convince them? Couldn't you give a good, solid, knockdown, ironclad, philosophical proof that certain things are right by nature?
Anarchy emerges. The son beats the father, and he's threatening to beat the mother. You have complete chaos and anarchy when the conventions are ignored and ridiculed.
But wouldn't that be the case only if the conventions were ignored and ridiculed, but nothing else was put in their place? You see, why is it that Aristophanes seems loath to completely substitute nature for the gods? You can look forward to someone like Aristotle, who tries to give, you know, rational, nature-based justifications for moral living. Why Aristophanes clearly believes that that's possible, but why doesn't he avail himself of that? Why wouldn't Aristophanes, if he were alive today, basically say, look, one of the purposes of public education should be to strip away all of people's religious superstitions and teach them the right way of living, which can be justified by a rational appeal to human nature. So you're saying that what's one of the things that's natural to us is that we have these religious illusions? I mean, all religions can't be true.
Right.
So even if you're a partisan of the truth of one, you have to, if you take that seriously, regard all the others as illusory. And you have to come up with some kind of explanation for why people are so prone to these illusions. And you'd have to say, well, it seems to be natural. But still, a lot of these illusions give rise to such attitudes as slavery or widow burning and things like that. I mean, wouldn't you just want to get rid of those things? Sweep them away? Teach these Indians to respect women? You know? I mean, wouldn't that be a good thing? Why would Aristophanes draw back from this conclusion? He seems to draw back from it.
And he's seen with this belief, skepticism that's already led to the corruption of the society, the public morals, and the private morals of the human population.
Right, but again, there's a difference between what he would be saying and what they're saying,
right,
the old
right.
corruptors. The old corruptors are amoral, but he's a kind of moralist.
Right.
So why not replace religious morals, not with self-seeking and hedonism and nastiness, but with intelligent, rational morals? Why not do that? Wouldn't that seem to be a great step forward in human civilization? And what's to prevent that? What's to prevent us from progressing from a religious superstition to an ethics based on religious taboos to a morality based on a rational understanding of nature? Well, I think that would clearly be part of it, but I don't think Aristophanes is one of these people who's in power, trying to hold the power to himself.
Of course, right?
Well, no, I want to see what comes up. Well, I mean, let me just raise this question. Can you imagine Strepsiades learning what's right by nature? Have we ever seen Strepsiades capable of learning anything by nature?
No.
Yeah.
No. After being in the company of Socrates for that period of time, he never once got it.
Never once did he.
Never, no.
He was.
He needs someone to be able to point to somebody to be hand of something.
Right. It's impossible for Strepsiades to have a non-theistic understanding of nature, right? As soon as he hears about the vortex, he just thinks that's Zeus's son who's overthrown him. And Pheidippides is apparently in the same boat. I mean, one of the things that you learn when you look at human nature, right, is what? When you look at human nature, what do you see? Well, that's true, but also you see that some people are more capable of changing than others. Exactly. I mean,
but he's an old man.
He's old and slow, and he knows himself. And in fact, at the beginning, he says, "I know myself to be old and slow," which is something that Socrates doesn't know. But that's what Socrates' motto becomes later: "Know yourself." Strepsiades knows himself, and he knows that he's old and slow. He's literal-minded. He's kind of dumb. Now. And what Aristophanes is showing us is that part of Socrates' lack of knowledge of human nature is manifested in his willingness to try and teach what nature is to someone like Strepsiades. Because he looks at Strepsiades and he doesn't see that Strepsiades can't learn, and to what extent he does learn will just eventuate in his corruption rather than his improvement. Right? And that one ought not to want to have those kinds of students. They bring disgrace and destruction upon yourself. This is what a man who would know something about human nature would conclude about Strepsiades, but Socrates doesn't. And this is his undoing. Socrates is unaware of human nature and specifically the different kinds of human beings, the different types of men. And there are some types who can never know what exists by nature, what's right or wrong by nature. And therefore, if you ask, well, how do they learn what's right or wrong? Well, they learn it through religion. However, you know, he's also fully aware that religion is somewhat limited, and that one of the quickest ways of corrupting a society, put it this way, I think the average American who believes in Christianity is morally better than they would be if they didn't believe in anything. However, if you became too enthusiastic about the Bible, I think that chances are you would be worse than a non-believer. This is one of the dangers. You know, there's lots of stuff in the Bible, you know, go out and kill the Canaanites and the last man. Well, okay, we have to go find the Canaanites and kill them. This professor at the University of Georgia was a very orthodox Jew, and he claimed that he followed all the laws. And a friend of mine who was studying with him said, well, what about killing all the Canaanites? And he said, well, they're all dead. And I said, well, he said, I didn't say this, my friend said this, well, what if you were, you know, the new neighbors moved in next door, and you were to go over to give them a housewarming gift, and you'd discover Canaanite literature on their coffee table. I mean, what would you do? And he was just appalled that he had to face this question and somebody was bringing this up. But he didn't know what he would do. And the thing is that he was really better than his religion, right?
Yeah.
Because he wasn't an enthusiast, and he was only following basically the good precepts of it and not following the bad ones. Okay? And the capacity to distinguish between good and bad precepts of religion presupposes, doesn't it, some sense of what's right and wrong over and above what the religion tells you.
Well, okay. Acknowledging conventions is part of human wisdom and acknowledging human nature. I mean, if you're a student of human nature, you would have to acknowledge conventions.
You'd have to acknowledge that they're natural, but they're not,
they
you don't necessarily have to acknowledge that they're all good.
No, right.
You see, that's the thing. And one of the things that's very clear about the clouds, again, is the recognition that the gods are just as much a source of morality as they are a source of corruption.
Ooh.
And one of the things that leads to the gods being a source of moral corruption is this, is the idea that you should do as the gods do, rather than do as the gods say. Remember, Zeus says, honor your father. Zeus himself overthrew his father. You know? And Zeus came from a pathological, dysfunctional family, yet he's the god of the family order. That works fine as long as you recognize that you're supposed to do as Zeus tells you, but not do as Zeus does. But the way that the unjust speech undermines the traditional moral teachings is he says to Pheidippides, why not do as Zeus does, right? Wouldn't piety be doing as Zeus does? Zeus philanders, so should you. And if you're caught in the act, you just jump up and say, who are you to go against the ways of Zeus? Okay. And so there's a recognition that religion is both an extremely powerful way of teaching morals to those sorts of people who simply couldn't be guided by anything but revelation. Yet at the same time, there's a recognition that religions themselves are somewhat ambiguous in their moral teachings, and therefore they have to be carefully managed. The only way you could manage them and pick and choose amongst the moral teachings is if you already knew in some way, on the basis of nature, what's good or bad. And so this is an interesting and complex teaching that comes out of here.
Isn't that an obstacle also? Let's say you're taking a newborn babe and you're going through the stages of development. If you didn't have the religion there, and wouldn't that, if the religion is there, wouldn't you be preoccupied teaching a child the precepts of the religion versus starting them off by teaching them this natural or this moral standard according to nature and this objective good?
Well, you see, one thing that I think the point you're making is good, and Freud actually makes this in The Future of an Illusion. It's not in his own voice, but in the voice of his critic. Who actually has criticisms that are so powerful that Freud eventually, I think, succumbed to his own feigned self-criticisms and changed his mind. But in this book, the critic says to Freud, how can society afford to give up on the use of religion as a moral teacher and replace it with reason, given that reason does not fully develop until a person is after their, you know, puberty? Would we be able to delay moral teachings until after puberty? No. That would be an absolute disaster. I forget who said this. Maybe I said it. But every new generation of children is an invasion of barbarians. Children come into the world amoral, selfish, and wicked. You know, they torment bugs, they torment cats, they torment one another.
Never do.
They come into the world very egocentric and nasty, I think, and to the extent that they don't have good surroundings, they'll remain that way. That's my sense. I don't think children, put it this way, children are morally innocent in a certain way because they don't know any better. But they're also very destructive and very nasty. My sense is that, in fact, what happens is every new generation emerges from the womb little unsocialized barbarians, right? Barbarians are people who don't have any social skills. Social graces, social skills, sense of right and wrong. And the task of education is to civilize the barbarians before they overwhelm you. And, you know,
they overwhelm you anyway.
I know, but you know, but every civilization has to educate the young from the very beginning. Because if they don't, it doesn't matter what their enemies outside are going to do to them, because they'll be overwhelmed by their own children who've never been taught to say to be decent or to know that to look for the difference between right and wrong. You get kids who are just egocentric and basically worship the whim of the moment. I think that and you know, I hope no one went to a Montessori school here, but I went out and visited St. John's College. You went to St. John's for a year. Okay, so I'm going to tread very carefully here. And the impression I had of the students was sort of like it was a big Montessori school, because the Montessori kids that I was around when I was, say, in high school, who went to Montessori school, is that they were bright and they loved to learn, but they had absolutely no control over their impulses. And the way the education works is that if you feel like doing this, you do this, and if you don't feel like it, you do something else. And so they had no way of inhibiting their impulses. Yeah, well, I think they never got out of this, because they were the kinds of people who would simply do whatever they felt like impulsively. And you couldn't depend on them. Like, you're supposed to meet so-and-so for lunch. You're waiting and waiting. They don't show up, you know. And a number of my friends who went through St. John's, St. John's is a this is what a friend of mine said. It's a kind of combo of Montessori and Mortimer Adler. It's the great books, but it also... Mortimer Adler is the great book. Yeah, but Montessori is the sort of kind of impulsiveness and kind of willfulness of the way that the students conduct themselves in intellectual discussions. Because in the classroom setting, there's no teacher really. There's just sort of a discussion moderator. But the thing is that where are we going with this? But the thing is that there are kinds of education that, put it this way, if children are left to their own devices, they tend to be very much impulsive, egocentric, and driven by their feelings. And they don't ever come to a point where they learn the points to strategically suppress their desires, you know, to think long term about self-desire satisfaction. They become in some ways solipsistic and antisocial. You can't depend on them. They have a tenuous senses of obligations to others. And these sorts of patterns you can see in under-socialized or under-parented kids. Okay? And that is a big concern. If the only way you're going to educate your kids about right and wrong is to wait until they're 16 or 17, in effect what you're going to have is you're going to have uneducable kids, because they grow up sort of basically impulsive and ruled by their desires.
Why can't you teach that to them secularly? I mean, why does it have to be shrouded in a religious convention? Why can't you don't walk out in front of the car?
You teach that
very secularly. Why does it have to be?
And those things are really great. And you can even convince a person that those are good things, intellectually speaking. But unless they're taught that by habituation very early on, it doesn't really stick. And that's a terrible problem. And this is why, in a sense, inhibiting a child's impulsiveness early on is very good for them, because it gives them a solid grounding of habit, and then later on they can understand why these are good things to have, why it's good to be dependable or punctual. You see, but if they're never gotten in the habit of being punctual, then even if you can teach them rationally why punctuality is a good thing later on, it's still not going to be the kind of thing that sticks with them and can become the basis of a habit.
But aren't you giving religion a free ride?
Oh.
Because religion could be used by a tyrant.
And it has been.
Oh, of course.
I
mean, why?
Yeah. More so than anything.
Yeah.
We looked at both sides and how it can be make you worse or better, right, than the average untutored person. Religion can do both. Now, I'm just saying, let's look at the good side for moral education with young kids. Now, of course, it can warp them and ruin them at the same time if it's done badly. And so, again, it's got to be carefully managed. But there's a sense in which something like religious education seems to be indispensable for having a purchase on the minds of young kids. For instance, most religions teach morals in the form of stories, right? Now, if you don't have parables from the Bible, you know, you at least teach them other moral parables, because these things can be grasped. They don't have to have a general appreciation of the principles behind them. That can come later. But they need a concrete, vivid illustration of right and wrong behaviors and different consequences. Aesop's fables are great for this. The point is that religious education is ultimately education in the form of narratives, myths. And there are many other myths besides just religious narratives. But it's not fully rational, in a sense, education. But it's the kind of thing that anybody can grasp. Any human being, even an IQ of 60, can grasp stories and follow simple stories. It's amazing the capacity of narrative to cut across all the different levels and divisions that exist between people in terms of intelligence and aptitude. We can all listen to stories. Now, the stories have to be carefully managed, and if you look in Plato's Republic, remember, there's all these discussions of all the things that have to be gotten out of the stories that the Greeks tell their kids because they're bad examples.
And you could kind of almost even fill out the lies to show it off.
Well,
refrain from the truth.
Well, I mean, well, you know, when you talk about the fox and the grapes, if you ever tell your child the story of the fox and the grapes, anybody here? Is that story true? And you lied. You lied to your child. Shame on you. Shame on you. You see, when Plato talks about the noble lies, it's literally false stories.
Right.
False stories. Lies are not necessarily, false stories are not necessarily lies in the invidious or the immoral sense. Although you tell kids stories that are false all the time. Where do babies come from? Yeah. But, yeah, well, let's not be dragged down into modern life now. But anyway, what's crucially important to understand is that there's a teaching about the relationship of morality and religion that's implied in the clouds that we're going to see next time when we look at Plato's Euthyphro. Okay, so all these things need to be sort of amplified from the lesson of the clouds so that we'll start seeing these things in Plato as we go along.